This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good evening. It is Wednesday, December 16th, 2012. Topic for today in current Jewish questions is the issue of mitzitza b'feh, or mitzitza b'feh, b'peh. Technically, it's b'feh if you're, grammatically accurate, so alternate either way. So this is, still a pretty current Jewish question in New York. It's still being hammered out in the legal system. There was some law that was passed, I believe now it's was held up in the courts, about whether or not this particular practice is legal or illegal. What is this practice? It is the practice of a mohel at a brit, the one who's doing the circumcision. Being a mohel, I'll use that term consistently as a proper name. I don't want to keep translating that. So a mohel is the guy who performs the circumcision at a brit milah. So the practice is, after he does the brit milah, will orally suck out some blood. That's what the practice is. And we'll start off with a few statements here that it's, the first couple of sources here are from the New York Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. So start us off, Tovia, with source number one. And you have the links here. So go ahead. Do you mind reading the first source?
It's not funny.
Where it says June 6, 2012.
Yeah, so that's my birthday.
So this is when they released it. So go ahead.
June 6, 2012, the New York City Health Commissioner Dr. Thomas Farley today issued statements strongly that urging that the rectal oral genitalia suction not be performed during Jewish ritual circumcision, and announced that several hospitals, including those serving Hasidic Jewish communities and all health and hospital corporations, hospitals have urged to distribute a brochure that describes the risk of contracting the herpes virus from this practice we know as mitzvah b'peh.
Mitzitza b'feh. That's how they wrote it.
Health Department investigation, newborns with herpes virus between 2000 and 2011 shown that 11 infants contracted the herpes virus when molium or ritual circumstances placed their mouth directly on one of the child's circumcision. Oive. To draw blood away from the circumcision. 10 of these infants were hospitalized, and 2 of them developed range damage, and 2 of them babies died.
Yeah. And he continues saying there's no safe way to perform oral suction on any open wound in a newborn. Right? Now, this is a pretty serious issue. 11 infants contract herpes, 10 hospitalized, 2 developed brain damage, and 2 died.
I know a pediatrician that works at one of these hospitals. She recently told me about this.
Yeah.
That she had 2 patients that died.
Yeah, there was one, there was one particular mohel whom, even after it was known, was still, performing this. Take the next source, before the brit. This in fact was the brochure that they were handing out, also from the New York Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. Before the bris, how to protect your baby against infection. So this is what was recommended by the New York Department of Health and Mental Hygiene.
A practice called mitzitza b'peh, direct oral suctioning, is performed during some religious circumcisions, bris. Direct oral suctioning has been associated with infections and death of babies caused by herpes simplex type 1 virus, HSV-1, the virus that causes cold sores of the mouth. Direct oral suctioning is performed by some mohelim or religious circumcisers in the Jewish community. With this practice, the mohel's mouth and lips come into direct contact with the baby's circumcision wound during the bris. The New York State Department of Health and New York City's Department of Health. And mental hygiene has documented the number of cases of HSV-1 infection on or around the genitals in male babies after circumcisions that included direct oral suctioning. Some of these babies became seriously ill. Some developed brain damage and others have died. There is no proven way to eliminate the risk of HSV-1 infection from direct oral suctioning.
Yeah, now let's just do a little bit of the next paragraph about how exactly does it cause infection. You okay?
Yeah, I'm just... Sorry. I'm very disturbed.
So we'll just do like a little bit of this first paragraph, and then we'll skip to the next one. So yeah, go with that. How exactly does it cause infection?
How Hametzitza bepeh can cause infection. More than half of adults have oral HSV-1 infection. This infection may cause cold sores of the mouth, but most people with oral HSV-1 do not have cold sores and do not know they are infected. People can spread the virus to others even when they don't have any cold sores. Even though HSV-1 causes cold sores in most people, newborn babies are at risk for severe infection if they're exposed to the virus. This is because their immune systems are still not mature enough to fight off infection.
Oh, yeah, sorry. All right, and with direct oral suction, suctioning, the mole places his mouth and lips directly on the baby's circumcision. So basically, you've got an open wound, a very easy way to transmit, you know, disease, and you've got a baby, right, at 8 days old, has an incredibly weak immune system. That is a recipe for disaster. And it mentions here some other alternatives. I mean, if you want to do this practice, for example, it says sometimes a glass tube or glass tube is attached to a rubber bulb is used to suction in a way that does not include contact between the mole's mouth and a baby's cut. Others use a sponge or sterile gauze pad to suction blood. And it adds that there is no proof that the strategy that while Mohalim may rinse their mouths with alcohol-containing mouthwash, containing mouthwash, or even take antiviral medications, there's no proof that these strategies reduce the risk of HSV-1 infection associated with direct oral suctioning. All right, and there's more here which we're going to skip, from the brochure. But, you know, read on your own. It's, I think, fascinating that they have to deal with this. Which leads us to the question that given, how did we get to this place? Yeah. Where we've got this ritual of Mitzitza Befeh, of direct oral suctioning, and it's still going on today, even though it really causes harm in many, many instances. Or at least, the risk of causing damage is certainly there. Meaning, I don't know, who has, you may not know that you have a particular virus, such that, you can't even necessarily protect yourself. Right? So why do we keep on doing this? How did this come up? And why this is, I think, a fascinating discussion for us today is that you have, as we're going to see in a bit, we have a lot of questions that can come up in terms of how do we apply an ancient Talmud rule to today? And it's just a few, like some very short lines from a Mishnah in the Gemara that leads to a huge, huge debate throughout the generations. So Josh takes, this is what I have, the source number, I guess, 3. This is a, or should have been 3A and 3B. So it's a Mishnah in Shabbat 19.2, and then followed by discussion in Gemara Shabbat 133b.
Okay. We perform all the requirements of circumcision on the Sabbath. We circumcise, uncover the corona, suck the wound, and place a compress and cumin upon it.
Yeah, sort of like a healing type of causing, something like that. All right. So in the Mishnah, you have this word umotzitzin. There's something about sucking that's mentioned in the Mishnah in Shabbat. So in the Gemara, this would be the next paragraph. This is Gemara Shabbat 133b.
Yes, so we suck out, etc. Rav Papa said, if a surgeon does not suck the wound, it is dangerous and he is dismissed.
Wow. So why does the Gemara say that you need to do this mitzitza, explaining the Mishnah? Sakanahu. Because if you don't, it's dangerous. And if he doesn't do it, because he's doing something that's it would seem to be put the child's health at risk, you don't let him do a mila, which is exactly the opposite of what we have today. So, we got a bunch of questions that we can ask on this. Go for it.
Well, I mean, if, knowing what they now know, like, if their logic for doing it was that... Right, it was to protect medically health, the health of the child, it would seem that knowing what we know now, they would feel differently about the whole Mitzitza Befeh.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it seems obvious. Like, if it's sakana, that's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Then this is sakana. Like, this is dangerous.
Okay.
To expose a child to an infection.
Mm-hmm. Right.
My only question is, where did we exactly get the practice from and where did it actually begin?
Right, so according to the Gemara here, right, it seems to be a Mishnah, it's as old as the Mishnah at least. Based on the Gemara's explanation, it was something that was done to the child that in their day they thought was necessary because it was healthier. That seems to be the origin of the practice, right? But here are a couple of questions, and the truth is, the point that you raise is actually doubly loaded, right? Like, we can split those out too. Because when you say, like, well, what happens when you've got one issue of science of the Gemara versus science of today? You've got a matter of legislation. Is this still a matter of halacha, a matter of Jewish law, in which case we still have to do it even though we know better, right? That we just have to stick with this practice. Or do we say that no, it was really just, sakana is not necessarily the same thing as danger. Meaning, here would be the difference. If it would be an actual rabbinic decree of obligation, then you would have a rabbinic obligation, or you would have some religious obligation to perform mitzitza befev, regardless of whether or not the reason of health mattered or doesn't matter. Right? To give an example, we don't eat fish and meat on the same plate because of sakana. Now, even though there doesn't seem to be any, you know, danger associated, people do it all the time. Restaurants, you know, that I don't go to at least have surf and turf meals, you know. Clearly people are having fish and meat on the same plate without any issue, aside from, you know, morbid obesity, which doesn't count. Right? So do you stick with that or no? Pretty big question there. Right? What do you do when your science changes? Or how much are you allowed to change? Or what about even the details of the ritual? Right? Because in terms of whatever this mitzitza was, it would seem that it would have been bepet because there doesn't seem to be another way, you know, that how you would do it. So can you, does it have to be in exactly the same way that the Gemara said? Or, you know, could you change it slightly? And, you know, all these questions, you know, they may, you know, seem trivial or not, but these come up in so many halachic issues. So when you tackle this thing of mitzitza befeh, it's also, yes, it's very relevant to today, but it also helps illustrate just the challenges of what happens when you try to take these ancient laws that don't seem to make a whole lot of sense, and worse than don't seem to make a whole lot of sense, you have scientific evidence that it's based on a false premise, right? And then, well, how do you adjust it? Right? Do you just go and say, well, our science takes precedent, regardless of what the Gemara says? Or do you say, well, it's still on the books, it's still a halakha, it's still a law, and we have to do it in some way versus continuing? Not to mention, you can have a whole lot of other factors that go on. So there was an article called Brit Milan, the Scepter of AIDS, written by Alfred S. Cohn from the RJJ Journal, Journal of Halakha and Contemporary Society, in 1989. And he, one of the things that he writes in there, he does quote primary sources, but I don't have access to these primary sources, which, you know, when they're not in the sheet, I'll have to just quote the author of an article. So there was a bit of a controversy at a certain point in Jewish history. This is discussing Maharam Sheikh, who lived in the 1800s, and he was combating reform. Now, in that time, the question wasn't just mitzitza b'peh, but circumcision in general. It's barbaric, it's antiquated, anachronistic. There's no reason why modern, you know, people today ought to continue going through ritual circumcision. Right? Now, keep in mind, you know, this was, you know, back in the 1800s. Today, you know, there have been enough studies that have shown that male circumcision at least has, you know, health benefits. You know, demonstrating whole, you know, so maybe it's like not just anachronistic, there's actually a medical purpose to it. But here's how the Maharam Sheikh handled things. Maharam Sheikh took an active part in the controversy, for by the time he was writing, he saw that the assault on Brit Milah was more than just an endeavor to improve the welfare of Jewish infants. He clearly understood that the true impetus for all the polemics was a challenge to the authority of the rabbis, and even more, a challenge to the supremacy of halacha, to the belief of Torah Mishamayim, Torah as being a divine instrument. In his rulings, he forbade a mohel from participating in a brit milah which did not include mitzitza b'peh. Moreover, he goes so far as to argue that the possibility of mitzitza b'peh is on the level of halacha l'Moshe Misinai, meaning, i.e., an express oral tradition dating back to Moshe Rabbeinu, in which case, even if it could be argued that nature has changed, no change in the tradition could be countenanced. So you've got a halachic authority that's taking a really hardline approach, in his view, to combat assimilation, right? And when you have people who are challenging the entire system, you saw this, you know, a lot more with Chatam Sofer, right? Well, as soon as someone tries changing, you know, anything, it's almost like the slippery slope argument, where if we give up any one of our details in halacha, then the whole thing could easily fall by the wayside, right? So, you know, you throw in just the simple act of the perception of a change of tradition, and you're approaching this from, I was just at a Rabbis Without Borders conference, and they spoke a lot of, you know, postmodernism and meta-narratives and narratives and stuff like that. So if you view it from this narrative of, you know, assimilation, we're losing all our rituals, the way that you'll compensate is by doubling down on every little thing that you have, even if, you know, it might not, even if it means almost exaggerating the importance of every single detail. And you know, you found that if you go check out the Politics of Exclusion series, you see that a little bit more with some of the innovations that were going on at the time. You know, do you integrate English in the services? When, you know, even though you've got Gemaras to talk about praying in every language, any deviation at the time was considered a huge risk on, you know, the global social scale about what was Judaism going to turn out. This is what, and he even mentions, you know, the legal point of if it is halacha l'Moshe Misinai, his view, and he, you know, his view is, if this came, you know, from Moshe or Sinai, that mitzitza has to be done orally, that you have to do the oral suction, then even if the nature changed and you know better, you'd still have to do it. That was his argument. Now, whether or not he actually believed that, or whether or not he was giving an anti-reform polemic, is a little bit difficult to parse. Given just how much else was there, and you'd have to read a whole lot of Maharam Shik and see, you know, exactly what he wrote and how he wrote it, and, you know, what are the intentions, but that gets a little bit off topic. But there's also a bit of a dispute in terms of the changing of nature and whether or not we actually hold to that. Tavi, could you take, this is a Ramah in Evan Ezer 1564.
Okay, even though the Talmud states that an 8-month-old fetus is not viable, many wonder that this teaching of the Talmud that an 8-month baby cannot live for experience denies the validity for their
validity. Experience denies the validity of their teaching.
Therefore, we must now say nowadays that there has been a change in this matter, and not so in the number of situations.
Right? So he says, you know, Akshav Nishtaneha Inyan. Right? And this is an interesting, you know, approach where people feel uncomfortable saying Chazal got science wrong, or Chazal got anything wrong. So instead of saying that, gee, they were incorrect when they, you know, said that it's an 8-month fetus is not viable, right? We know that to be false, right? Chazal have a whole lot of statements scattered throughout there, particularly in the areas of science, biology, and anatomy, that are flat out wrong and can be disproved and have been disproved. So your approach is, you know, one of two ways. If you have, you know, approach that, you know, one approach could be very rational, which is the sages did the best they could with what they had, and that this was the science of their day. We know other things now. They were incorrect, not because they were stupid, but because they just didn't have the same wealth of information available now, right? When you don't have electron microscopes, you can't really do cellular biology. I'm getting the science thing wrong, but you get the point. When you don't have the equipment, you can't make any of, and it took centuries, if not, you know, a couple millennia of scientific advancement to get to where we are today. A lot of stuff happened. Forget even that. Just even the past 100 years, just how much we found out about stuff, right? So to say that they were wrong, you know, is, you know, a factual approach, but it's not a value judgment as much as, you know, yeah, they had no way of knowing, right? Another way is nishtaneha inyad, which is a saying that, well, we don't want to say that they were wrong. Instead, it's almost, if you've invested so much of your, you know, emotional, mental, spiritual capacity in the sages never, ever being incorrect, getting a factual piece incorrect, it's easier for you to say that nature changed rather than say the sages were wrong. and that it's easier for you to say the sages were right with the science in their day, but today things are different and something happened. So it could be when they were writing the Gemara, it was in fact impossible for an 8-month fetus to be considered viable. Now, okay, so we know better, so something changed. Which, incidentally, if you do hold of this nishtana teva, nature changed, even though it's coming out of an area, or at least maybe a mindset of a certain fundamentalism, that the rabbis are always right, you're kind of arguing for evolution. That's what nishtana teva is. Nature changes, right? Things change over time, that's evolution, no art, and right? So it's weird that that's kind of what you get to. Like, from your fundamentalism of rabbis can never be wrong, right? Nature has to change. Well, so that's evolution. There you go. So this is one approach here, but this is also an approach that we do apply really, really inconsistently. Sometimes it does come up nishtana hateva, that, you know, people will say, yeah, it doesn't matter so much anymore. So if it comes time to mitzitza bepeh, right? In theory, you could apply this argument and say, well, although I think Eric Konier quoted Shulchan Aruch, a passage in Shulchan Aruch, which I actually couldn't find, seemed to say that you do everything for the purpose that was always done, having hot water for the baby is considered part of the brit for health purposes. Even though the nature's changed, you know, we still do this because, that's what was done. So, yeah. So that could, any thoughts so far? Or at least on the, approach to this question?
It's like you're going after the whole entire religion.
Maybe, maybe not. It depends. You see, a lot of this then is going to depend a priori on what exactly is your approach to begin with, right? I don't think you necessarily have to get stuck in this corner unless you've pegged yourself there. Meaning, if you've already set up your construct as rabbis and the sages have never been wrong about anything, or never could, even if you don't want to say wrong, let's say that's too harsh. Let's say it's mistaken, right? But the truth is, the Gemara is full of mistakes. Just to give one example, one type of mistakes, the Gemara has issues about what did a Mishnah say, or what did a person actually say, right? People quote things incorrectly all the time in the Gemara. It's, this isn't how it should be read, rather, here's how you should read the Mishnah, right? So it's arguing that there's something missing. It's not 100% perfect, right? And things have to get fleshed out there, right? So it really, if you're going to approach it from, again, a fundamentalist standpoint, you're going to back yourself into certain corners that you'll need to get out of.
You're saying since Har Sinai, since the 900 years till we started writing down the Gemara, or is it after 900 years when we started writing it down?
I'm saying that, the Gemara even mentions, we did this in the Sunday class, there are a couple of sources that say that when Moshe Rabbeinu died, a whole slew of halachot were forgotten and needed to be reconstituted. Right, those are mistakes. Human fallible mistake things that happen. Now, whether or not you take that as literal historical fact is something else. But there's no sense that sages are 100 have gotten everything right. There are things today that we know are that even though they're in the Talmud, we know are biologically wrong. Saying that sucking out blood after circumcision somehow has a health benefit. Say it.
It's wrong.
Is wrong. Exactly. Now, it might have been, look, don't forget, back in the time of the Gemara, right, leeches were pretty much your health care, right? Bloodletting was common. It was considered healthy, right? These were their doctors. Like, they didn't have, that's what they did, right? You were saying?
I was just going to say, isn't there sort of a loophole with the Pikach Nefesh, now that we have the scientific information that backs up the fact that this is possibly fatal for newborn babies, that in order to save their life, that this halacha needs to be foregone.
Okay, so that's actually a good point. Do number 7 here. Yeah, not necessarily. This is also from Rabbi Cohen's Brit Mila and the Scepter of AIDS article.
Well, I know he's going to disagree with me.
Well, it's in this particular paragraph. I mean, yes, it's we're skipping one. We'll get back to it. Read that piece, because that actually addresses your specific point.
Another remedy is suggested by Rabbi Menashe Klein in a public letter, wherein he adamantly defends mitzitza bepeh. He proposes that a baby's blood can easily be tested for the presence of AIDS cells or antibodies prior to Mila, and Moalim could be certified by their rabbis as having been tested free of AIDS contamination. These steps, he feels, would prevent the spread of the disease through Brit Mila. Although this is a very intelligent proposal, it might be exceedingly difficult to implement. Families might fear being labeled as AIDS carriers if their baby tested positive. There would be a great deal of pressure to suppress such findings, perhaps even to lie about them. In addition, it might be very difficult to get Moalim to agree to certification and to assure that only certified Moalim could be used.
Right? So this, you know, is a way of, well, you could maintain your tradition. You could maintain the practice. I do find it weird here that part of the proposal was, it says Moalim could be certified by their rabbis as having been tested free of AIDS, as opposed to, say, a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I don't know what rabbi has, you know, was it hematology? Is that the blood part?
I think so.
Right. We don't have that type of training in rabbinical school. Or at least I didn't. All right. I can't do blood tests.
But you could see the chokma in his writing.
Right. So he's trying to come up with a solution, which is, what is the problem? Right. What is the tension here? We have a traditional practice. We want to keep the traditional practice as is. This traditional practice does have a textual basis in the Gemara. Right? And seems that this is how we've done this Gemara, or practiced what was said in this Gemara for so long, yet there is also a clear risk of health of transmitting a disease. Here it's specifically talking about AIDS, but in theory this would apply to hepatitis too. And a solution would simply be this. Instead of getting rid of the entire ritual, or the practice of mitzitza bepeh, just test the mohels first, right? Make them show recent blood tests. I mean, the truth is, you know, what does certified mean also? Like, you would have to do regular blood tests pretty much before every time you do a Mila, you would have to do it. Because otherwise, you know, I could get blood tested today. You know, who knows what I pick up in 25 years still doing Mila, you know, but I'm certified as being okay. Right? So, yes, there are flaws here, but let's say you even get past those flaws. Let's say you come up with a thing, you know, Moel, every time he does a Brit, does Mitzitza Ben, needs to bring a recent blood test, to show that he's not diseased. And then, you know, that would clear him in order to do Mitzitza Bepeh.
And they're saying also the baby would need to be tested so that the rabbi wouldn't be at risk.
I have no idea. Right. So that if the baby would have some disease, you don't want the Moel contracting it either. Or let's say, I mean, think about it this way. It's not uncommon for a Moel to do, you know, more than one Brit in a day, right? So if Moel does one, you know, then he could, in fact, so he does one Mitzitza Bepeh with the first one. Who knows what he transfers to the next, right? Not so simple. Not to mention, you know, the other issues that are mentioned here in terms of what does it mean for the family, right? So that's one approach to the struggle. Could you do... source number 6, going back one?
Sure.
Yeah. So this is the Tzitz Eliezer. I mean, it's an approach that's used often, but this happens to be cited by the Tzitz Eliezer, who passed away recently. He was the major posek for, I believe, Shari Tzedek Hospital in Israel, and he has a lot of medical ethics type of responsa. So go ahead. Just one quick line from it.
And because it's impossible to perform mitzitza orally, it is possible to perform it with a sponge. Because if one were to do nothing, the child would be in danger.
Right, so here he throws in, he does a little bit of both here. He says, you know, you could do mitzitza, but it doesn't have to be oral, right? And he uses the issue of a sponge, but there are other things that people use, like a glass tube, or something along the lines of, what's the thing?
Like a
medicine dropper thingy. You know the thing, the suction thing with the rubber at the end?
Yeah, a little turkey pincers.
Thank you.
That they, like, pull the boogers out of the babies.
If you say so, yeah. Right? So, I mean, I cited the Tzitz Eliezer because the Tzitz Eliezer offers another solution, right? And his solution is, well, the Gemara says you do mitzitza. He still says here, right, let me tell you, yisa kana leyeled. He is still saying that not doing any sort of suction is a danger to the child. That's still in the Tzitz Eliezer. But... What he also does is he gives you an alternative. It doesn't have to be with direct oral contact. You can do it through something else. You can do it through one of those medicine dropper thingies. You can do it through with a sponge. You can accomplish the same goal of what the Talmud mandates, because according to the Talmud, it's just releasing certain amount of blood from the wound. Right? Mm. That's what the Talmud talks about. But it doesn't say how. Right? Now, if you're going to be a super hyper-traditionalist, no detail is ever allowed to change. But the Gemara just says it has to be, you know, squeezed out. So you're doing that. You're sucking it out. Right? It's just that instead of direct mouth, you're sucking it out through air pressure of a medicine dropper. Mm-hmm. Right? So this is another solution to the problem, and some people will actually do that. And this way, you can, regardless of what you, I mean, again, Tzitzit Eliezer maintains that it's a danger. But even if it's not a danger, and you know better that it's not a danger, you get to keep the tradition in some way. You're still following what the Gemara says, right? Which is to do it, right? And you don't have your problem anymore, right?
But this may be kind of funny and all, but the Hasidim always say about bringing Mashiach into the world. We don't know, you know. I understand his wisdom in solving the problem, but, you know, maybe some people are so pure and traditionalist, they may be, you know.
Well, you could argue that giving babies herpes doesn't really bring Mashiach either.
Right. That's the point that you said. You answered the question to my point, rambling on and saying, but, you know, it's you know, you want someone coming out?
I think so. You know, there's, so here's one of the articles about, I couldn't find him. This is the original source that I found. It was cited in a bunch of Jewish things. It's an article from something called the Jewish, the something journal. It's Lohud. I think it's Jewish Journal. It goes, Munsi Rabbi speaks out against controversial ritual and circumcision. And this is the position of Rabbi Moshe Tendler. I should say Rabbi Dr. Moshe Tendler, with whom I studied for 2.5 years at Yeshiva University. And he's eminently quotable. And he actually enjoys, you know, getting quoted, because he's you'll see why in a second. Josh, can you take this?
Tendler and many other experts contend that oral suction is not required by Jewish law as part of the ritual. It's a hoax perpetuated by some of the rabbis, said Tendler, who has been harassed for his stance on the topic. It's a prefabricated lie.
Stop there for a second. Wow. So Rav Moshe Tendler, again, like I said, flat out, it is a hoax and it is a prefabricated lie. Right? And he's saying that That the oral suction part is not an intrinsic part. It's not required. Huh. Flat out saying it. So, but
others maintain that oral suction is an integral part of circumcision. There are many rabbis who consider Matzitza Bepet to be unnecessary, said Avi Shafran, a rabbi and spokesman for Agudath Israel of America, an Orthodox organization. But there are many rabbis, including in Rockland County, I assure you, who feel quite strongly otherwise. But the ritual itself isn't the real issue, said Shafran, whose organization had threatened to sue New York City to overturn the law. The issue isn't really about the practice itself, but about whether it's proper in our country to interfere with the freedom of religious practice, Shafran said. That is a fundamental First Amendment issue, not one that Rabbi Tendler's point of view on the particular practice here can be allowed to obscure. Tendler said he understands why many religious groups bristle at the idea of government intervention. Should the government be involved, he asked. I concur that the government should not be involved. But if religious leaders don't act to ban the practice, secular officials will have little choice, he predicted. Few people in favor of the practice understand the risks it poses. And Tendler, who had a degree...
Said
Tendler, who had a degree in microbiology. They don't appreciate the fact that this exposes the child to danger, he said. Danger that a child is being exposed to for no reason.
Right. So the doctor part of Rabbi Dr. Moshe Tendler is he has a PhD in microbiology. And he once complained to me that he had to argue brain death with people who never went to college. This is a fascinating practical point here. When it came to the law, right, Rabbi Shafran's position is government should not get involved in any sort of religious practices at all. no matter what. And that's, you know, what he's sticking to. He is actually sort of sidestepping the halacha as much as, well, this is Rabbi Tendler's opinion, other people disagree. And then, you know, but that's a silly argument to have in a newspaper, right? Because, you know, no one's going to care. Okay, fine, rabbis have different opinions. But he's asking from a very practical sense, what about the law? Rav Tendler seems to say that this is a very real health risk. And we've seen documented health risks at the very beginning. We've had, I mean, you could say in theory, you know, that 11 infants contract, it says here, 11 infants contracted herpes virus when Moalim, right, placed their mouths directly on the circumcision from 2000 to 2011. So that's slightly less than one a year, right? Now you can say, well, because of one a year, it's not a big deal. But you can also say that one a year is far too many. Right? You could say that any time a child dies through an unnecessary ritual, right, that is just too much. I mean, I'm sure there must be numbers of, you know, who dies through circumcision at all if you don't know a kid is a hemophiliac. Although they probably do tests like that beforehand these days.
So.
Yeah. Right? You could have, in theory, complications, right? But no one's saying, like, ben brit milah. Rav Tendler's argument is this. There's no point to it. There is no merit to doing mitzitza bepeh. There is no gain, right? If you want to do mitzitza, you have other options available. Like, as it says, as you cited, you use a sponge, or you could use a glass tube, and you could have the same effect of keeping, you know, what's said in the Gemara. But to do it bepeh, there's no source anywhere that says you have a biblical or religious obligation, that it must be done in this way. And yes, the Maram Shik is not the source for either biblical or rabbinic prohibitions. Right? So given that there's no innate religious merit behind it, because God didn't command it, and Chazal didn't command you to do it in this particular way, and it does pose a very real risk to the health of the baby, you would say, then this really has to be stopped. And his other point is very well taken. Prioritizing the health of the baby, and this gets to the Bikuach Nefesh thing, ideally government should not get involved in religion. But it also behooves the religion to take care of itself, that it doesn't need government intervention. Because if the people in the religion are putting babies at risk and continue to do so, right, then yeah, state intervention is going to get necessary simply because you're not doing what you're supposed to do, so someone else has to. Right? And if you took care of your own thing, you wouldn't need the other stuff. You wouldn't need the state to... Exactly. You have an obligation to take care of the babies. And this is where you get again to that whole sakana issue. If you want to follow... I mean, I really hate to use this, but the, you know, original... If you want to follow the intent, there you go, of the Gemara, the intent is sakana. So if you know that this is a sakana, then don't do it. Right? Or rather, or at least, you know, if, you know, you're trying to, if the whole point is to prevent a sakana, and you know doing so in this way increases the sakana, then why? Exactly. Right? So you would say you'd even be going to, I know people hate, well, I hate this line, you know, the spirit of what the Gemara says. Because it's, yes, you do mitzitza to prevent injury to the child. All right, so if you want to keep the ritual part because you think it's a legislated decree, and even though nature changes, you have to do it, fine. But there's a way of doing the ritual without sakana. So do that. But mitzitza bepeh, to my mind, makes, you know, absolutely no sense. I mean, Rav Tendler happened to, like, I don't just cite him because I studied with him. He happens to be incredibly vocal about this, and because he has a PhD in biology, you know, really understands, you know, the risks, I would say, better than most rabbis, because he has, you know, a lot more firsthand knowledge and understanding of how this thing works. But it's been an issue. I think it's still held up in the courts. And we'll see how this happens. And, you know, hopefully...
And so Shem will still be held up in the courts.
Well, you know, I don't know. If the law helps prevent people from... I mean, the other question is this. I mean, just because you have a law on the books doesn't mean people do stuff. We're going to talk about that a little bit next week with gun control. I mean, Connecticut has, you know, really strict laws on gun control. And, yeah, I mean, it clearly didn't prevent one massacre. I mean, maybe it prevented another massacre, but it's not going to prevent all massacres. New York's got, you know, very strict gun laws. You know, it doesn't prevent people from, you know...
Stealing.
Not just stealing, from using guns. I mean, Plaxico Burress shot himself. You know, spent... Well, we'll talk about that next week. You know, but let's say there was a law passed, you know, unless you have, like, policemen at every single Brit Milah, you know, the only thing that you could do is if you track down a Moel that, you know, passed on herpes, then you could, in fact, prosecute him. Which, by the way, is not a bad idea.
Because if you can find out, because, look, if you want to say that a mohel could or could not find, but it, once you can demonstrate, hey, this mohel did something, then, yeah, there could actually be financial liabilities, but criminal, you know, consequences.
Well, they are criminals if they're theoretically killing a baby.
Like, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, but you say they're criminals, but legally, unless it's actually, like, something in the penal code. I also don't know exactly what the legislation is or how it's phrased because I'm not a lawyer.
Those two babies that died.
You can sue for there are things of like suing for negligence. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know exactly how that works legally. You'd have to speak to a criminal lawyer. Like in civil law, you could probably sue, but whether or not you can say that it was,
like the parents could sue.
Well, yeah, but the truth is, if you are the type of parent who's going to get a mohel that does mitzitza bepeh, you're probably not going to sue in secular government.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you would, unfortunately, in some of these communities, you would be the one who'd be ostracized for, taking down but he's such a great mohel type thing. Yeah, it's, but, if there's some other penalties, then maybe you can have enough of a deterrent for even if not stopping mitzitza bepeh altogether, to deter people who may have herpes or some other, virus or some other communicable disease to not do mitzitza bepeh or stop being mohels, right? Because if you just can't do the job, you're unhealthy, your health does not allow you to do the job, then just stop doing it. Like, blind people can't be surgeons. If they try, it would be really bad. Right, they're not bad people. It just means due to a physical or medical condition, they cannot do the task for which they are set out to do. And I would say having certain diseases would certainly apply to doing mitzitza bepeh. And again, this is all under the assumption that people are still going to do this anyway. And
most people pass in this. It's mostly Hasidic communities that do it still, isn't it?
I guess. I don't know.
I mean, that's the only place.
Not being a mohel. Well, also, you don't really know. I mean, the Brit happens so quickly, unless it's your own kid, and you're, like, standing right there. Most people don't really see what goes on, right? Mitzitza bepeh can be incredibly quick, right? So you don't really see. And he's also, like, bending down already to, like, to do the actual cutting. So you don't really know right there. But, yeah. So, I mean, you see here.
That's scary.
You've got a Gemara. Again, I mean, just to do a quick recap, you have a Gemara, really seems inapplicable today. We have a few reasons for why we would hold on to it, either pure halacha, of positivist halacha, that whatever the Gemara says we do out of matter of legislation. You have another extreme where it's not just what does the Gemara say, but do we perpetuate the tradition that we've happened to have inherited, regardless if it makes sense, and regardless if that was in fact mandated by the Gemara, because it's not just keeping the Gemara, but keeping specifically how we have practiced the Gemara, whether or not that makes sense. And for that, we talked about on Sunday in the popular practice and the process of Psak Shir on customs and minhagim, right? And then we found alternatives. Well, can you have the best of both worlds? Can you, one approach would be to reject it altogether and saying, yeah, it's a sakana, we don't care anymore. And there's a basis for saying that. Ashkenazi practice tends to be very inconsistent in terms of when they say danger is applicable or danger is inapplicable. Don't want to get there, that's a much longer conversation. But that would be one approach that you could find some basis for, of saying, yeah, you know what, doesn't matter anymore because we know it's wrong. Okay. And you have a middle ground where you can have the best of both worlds, in a sense, where you can keep what the Gemara says, literally, in terms of doing the suction, but you do it in a way, yes, you change the details of how you do it as you know more about the science. Because even if you want to say that mitzitza itself is in fact a Jewish ritual, mitzitza bepeh isn't, because the Gemara never said how it had to be done, it just said that it had to be done. All right? So you see just the different questions methodologically of when something like this comes up, how do you handle all of these conflicting ideas in ethics?
If the Gemara didn't say Matzitza bepeh, if it just said Matzitza.
Which it does.
So where did the...
Where did the peck come in? I'm guessing that was the best.
How it was done.
That's probably just how it was done. It was probably the easiest way that they had. Or, like, that's the way that they was like, how else do you do mitzitza? Like, to suck it out. Right? They probably just the only option. They might not have thought to do it any differently. Or you could even say medically, they might have even thought that doing it with a mouth might have even been better. I don't know. Right? All of those are possible. But since that clearly that part wasn't part of the legislation, you have more of room to, even to keep the ritual of mitzitza, to do it through another medium. or through another way, either through a sponge or through a medicine drop or something else. Yeah, all right?
There's both sides of the coin on there. I see both sides.
All right. So with that, so next week we're going to be doing gun control. So come back for that one.